From the World Newsroom in Boston, I'm Patrick Cox, and this is The World in Words, number 10. In this week's Apple Pie edition, free speech. Americans hold it dear, don't they? They object to its repression abroad, don't they? Sometimes. Also this week, an American Muslim family learns to choose its words carefully.
As a free man, I take pride in the words, Ich bin ein Berliner.
Sie se puede is right. Yes, we can.
There are no knowns. There are things we know that we know.
Yorkshire. Thanks, as always, Borat. The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH in Boston. There's lots about our show, including how to subscribe to all our podcasts at theworld.org. Okay, everyone, happy birthday, America. That's what a billboard in the Boston area proclaimed this time last year. But really, happy Independence Day to all of our American listeners. It does seem like a good time to talk about free speech, a right enshrined in the very First Amendment of the Constitution. Now, every U.S. government has claimed to promote free speech around the world. The Bush administration is certainly no exception, but, and this is a big but these days, you need trading partners. You need allies in the war on terror. You need friends among the oil-producing nations of the world, all of which may account for the fact that some nations are criticized far less than others for their lack of free speech. Take the tiny city-state of Singapore. It's a strong U.S. ally. It's tucked in between Malaysia and Indonesia, two huge Muslim countries with whom the Bush administration is on less friendly terms. There's also a U.S. military presence on Singapore. And yes, Singapore does take a bit of flack from the State Department once a year in a written report. The most recent report, which came out earlier this year, declared that the Singaporean government, quote, significantly restricted freedom of speech. One thing, though, that you have not seen is President Bush get behind a microphone and denounce Singapore's lack of freedoms. That said, despite only limited outside pressure, things in Singapore are changing slightly, as I reported recently. Here's something you wouldn't have witnessed in Singapore a few years ago, a play that deals with child sex abuse and Islam.
Read what they say. Investigations for the alleged crime of unnatural offense, carnal intercourse against the order of nature. I come home one day and the police is here.
The play is part of an officially sanctioned theater festival. The main female character is from Singapore's Malay minority. We watch as she struggles with her traditional Islamic subservience to her husband after she hears that he has sexually abused a young boy. The play's director, Alvin Tan, says it's an example of a new kind of agreement between the government and writers. Tan says the government is relaxing its censorship rules and writers are taking on society's problems in more nuanced, less political ways.
And that is something we've learned to make a piece more sophisticated, so that while treading on things that are sensitive, the play is still allowed to be staged in Singapore.
As are most plays. The exceptions are when things get too political.
Today, I would say there is as much artistic freedom as anybody wants, none politically.
That's Catherine Lim, Singapore's best-known novelist. She also writes a newspaper column that regularly criticizes the authorities for restricting free speech.
There's almost a pathological dislike for the mess associated with democracy and political freedom demonstrations, the kind of raucousness that you have in the US and so on. The government says, none of it, please, none of it, if you are going to survive as a nation.
Survival at the cost of some Western-style freedoms has long been unofficial policy in Singapore. The country's former leader, Lee Kuan Yew, who ruled for more than 30 years, outlawed most public demonstrations and sued some of his political opponents into bankruptcy. Lee's son, Lee Hsien Loong, is now prime minister. Here's what Lee Hsien Loong said in a PBS documentary when asked why Singapore didn't allow U.S.-style free speech.
We are in a different situation. It's a small country in an unstable environment, needing to watch out for many dangers which America does not have to worry about, needing to have the national agenda set by elected leaders with the mandate to set the agenda rather than by the media.
The Singaporean government is trying to update its repressive image. 7 years ago, the authorities opened their own Speaker's Corner, modelled on London Speaker's Corner. Ordinary Singaporeans would be allowed to speak there on any issue, except for religion and race. In its first 2 years, more than 1,000 people spoke at Speaker's Corner, and many more came to hear them. But things have changed. Okay, so here we are at Speaker's Corner. It's a busy Saturday morning. A lot of people out and about in Singapore today. It's a beautiful day, in fact. But here at Speaker's Corner, there are no speakers. There's nobody gathered to listen to any speakers. There's absolutely nobody. Maybe it's got something to do with the fact that there's a police station at the other end of the park, about 20 yards from Speaker's Corner. It's with the police that speakers must pre-register. Journalism professor Cherian George says Speaker's Corner was in fact designed to fail.
So that the government would be proven right that there isn't really an appetite for free speech in Singapore.
Despite that, George, who teaches at Singapore's Nanyang Technological University, says opposition politicians do have a few more rights than they used to. The internet has helped too.
Certainly there is greater opportunity now than before to get their message across. That, however, unfortunately still doesn't mean that you are guaranteed safe passage. This is still a government that believes in applying defamation law, for example, far more stringently than it is applied in the liberal West.
The government's ruling party certainly shows few signs of weakness. It holds 82 of the 84 seats in Singapore's parliament. But the voices of opposition, however distant, aren't vanishing. There are voices from abroad, like comments from an outgoing US ambassador to Singapore. He said the country's leaders will pay an increasing price for not allowing full participation of its citizens. And there are the voices at home, like Catherine Lim. She got into trouble a decade ago for criticizing the prime minister. In spite of that, her career as a novelist and columnist has continued to flourish.
I seem to be the only one. You know, there are others who have spoken out. The government responds with a letter and that's it. They have lost their column in the local newspaper or they shut up and I never hear from them again. So I seem to be a little bit of maverick on the scene, but maybe only by just biding my time. You know, my run of good luck may be over soon.
Or it may continue. As Lim says, her government needs a vocal critic so that it can say it allows free speech. For The World, I'm Patrick Cox, Singapore. Had enough of Singapore? Yes? No? Well, okay, I won't give you any more Singapore today, but I've got plenty more stories up my sleeve. So in podcasts later this year, we'll revisit the island to hear about all kinds of things, including its complaints choir that was banned. You see, there's a bit of a theme running here. Also to check in on a hybrid street language known as Singlish. Okay, I admit it, I have a Singapore obsession. Now, a lot of speech that is being prohibited or protected, depending on where you live, is online. We at The World have followed a lot of stories on bloggers who've run afoul of their governments. I'm sure we'll do a special on blogging in a podcast not too long in the future. There are also, of course, news organizations whose online articles get the reporters who wrote them into a lot of trouble. That has happened quite a bit in China. In one notorious case, two journalists were imprisoned after Chinese authorities retrieved the information about who wrote the articles from Yahoo. For that, Yahoo executives were castigated at a Capitol Hill hearing. And there's been a legislative response, too. A New Jersey congressman wants to prevent U.S. internet companies from turning over information about their users to countries that censor web content. Here's The World's technology correspondent, Clark Boyd.
It's called the Global Online Freedom Act, and it's sponsored by Republican Congressman Chris Smith of New Jersey. Smith's been working on the legislation for 3 years. He says it all started when he took a look at what he calls egregious and pervasive human rights abuses in China.
They were increasingly using the internet as a means of finding dissidents, religious and political, but also were censoring out information that would help the Chinese people know what's really going on.
And he says he realized something else, that U.S. tech companies were assisting the Chinese and others in that process.
Whether they like it or not, the software, the hardware that they have produced is being used as a sledgehammer against political dissidents and people who simply espouse democracy. No less than a water cannon or a rifle. This is part of the tools of repression. So our hope is to open it up.
The centerpiece of the Global Online Freedom Act is the creation of an Office of Global Internet Freedom at the U.S. State Department. That office would, on a yearly basis, designate countries as internet restricting. It would then prohibit U.S. companies from supplying those countries with the means to collect and monitor people's personal information. Smith says that would send a strong message to the Chinas of the world.
Our hope is that countries, when they realize that, and the businesses that enable dictatorships, you know, there will be pressure brought to bear to open these countries up, allow the political dissidents and the religious believers to use the internet without getting that knock on the door in the middle of the night and find themselves at a kangaroo trial and a 10-year prison sentence that includes torture.
Two of those allegedly tortured in Chinese prisons are Shi Tao and Wang Xiaoning. Both of them use the internet to criticize Beijing. Specifically, they use services provided by Yahoo in China. And when the Chinese authorities asked Yahoo for information about them, the company complied. That led to arrests and jail sentences for both Shi and Wang. Morton Sklar is the executive director of the World Organization for Human Rights, USA. He led a lawsuit against Yahoo in U.S. federal court, seeking damages for the families of Shi and Wang. Yahoo eventually settled that lawsuit, although the company maintained it was obligated, under Chinese law, to hand that information over to the authorities. Sklar says the Global Online Freedom Act would no longer make that an excuse.
Here the Congress is saying to the companies, look, you don't have to do that anymore. We are telling you that it's against our laws for you to provide this information.
But Sklar says the measure has its faults. He's worried about the requirement for the president to have final say on whether a country is internet restricting. Lucy Morillon, Washington director of the group Reporters Without Borders, sees a problem there as well.
We hope that it's going to be handled with care and that the executive branch is still going to be as tough on repressive countries that it denounces than on its allies. You know, Saudi Arabia is for us a major internet restrictive countries, and we would expect the same treatment than the one from Iran or China.
Of course, there are plenty of schools and libraries in America that actively filter internet content. Jonathan Zittrin holds the chair in internet governance and regulation at Oxford University. He says that if the bill passes, the United States might well be found violating its own law.
There could even be an irony, since the first Global Online Freedom Act asks the State Department to designate certain countries as internet freedom denying countries, if the United States would end up qualifying under its own law as an internet freedom denying country.
Congressman Chris Smith is looking to capitalize on the attention being paid to China in the run-up to the Summer Olympics. He's pushing hard to get the Global Online Freedom Act through the House. One potential snag? There's no similar measure currently making its way through the Senate. For the World, this is Clark Boyd.
So, Clark, you reported that story about 7 weeks ago in early May. How has the Global Online Freedom Act fared in the House?
Well, it's passed three crucial subcommittees that it needs to, so it theoretically could get to the floor. There's no Senate equivalent, though. And quite frankly, there are a lot of telecommunications companies, the big players, and people in the Justice Department who really don't like the language in the bill very much. And a lot of people think that it really doesn't have much of a future.
What do you put the resistance down to? Because the State Department already every year issues a country-by-country annual report on freedom. Why not just add internet freedom to it? There's more and more information online. And, you know, this would be a way in which the State Department could keep up to date.
Well, let's just read a little bit here from a State Department letter that was written to the House Foreign Affairs Chairman. The administration shares the view reflected in the Global Online Freedom Act that freedom of expression on the internet must be protected globally. Here it comes. However, the bill's key provisions, calling for labeling internet-restricting countries and penalizing certain affected U.S. firms in such countries, are likely to undermine U.S. diplomatic efforts and to interfere unjustifiably with such U.S. firms' commercial engagement in those countries. And for those reasons, the administration would oppose the bill, as reported to the House.
So when freedom rubs up against trade.
That is the big push and pull here. I think that there are a lot of big internet companies that have their lobbying tentacles pretty deep into Washington, and they feel like this is going to put an unjust burden on them to do business in places like China.
Okay, so we have Yahoo in China in a very big way. We also have Google, which is a slightly different situation. Where do the words, where do the information, where does that reside?
Well, see, this is the interesting part, I think, for your language podcast, is that a lot of this does come down to where those words actually are, where they're stored. Yahoo got in trouble because the servers that were storing these emails of these dissidents in the eyes of the Chinese government, were in China. And China had every right to go to Yahoo and say, this information is on your machines, we want it, and under Chinese law, you have to give it to us. And quite frankly, that gave Yahoo the out. We have to abide by the local laws. So we did it. In Google's case, Google has tried to get around all this by saying, well, if this is such an issue, let's put our servers outside of China. So you've got all these Chinese sending emails, whatever. All that's being stored, or all the searches that are being done, that's all being stored in servers outside of China. So the route there is that the Chinese government, if they felt like they wanted to get something from Google, would have to go petition the State Department and eventually get the go-ahead from the Justice Department for access to that. And quite frankly, that's a cumbersome process. Part of what the Global Online Freedom Act would do is sort of normalize that process and in a way force U.S. companies to keep those words outside of China.
Let's assume that this bill is not going to go anywhere, as seems likely. Is there any indication that Yahoo, which has been publicly shamed over this whole episode, is there any indication that they are changing their practices?
Well, the thing about public shame is that it doesn't last that long. And I think the feeling now is that while what happened to Yahoo was generally a good thing as far as the freedom of speech advocates were concerned, that spotlight has now dimmed quite a bit. For example, you know, along with what happened to Yahoo on Capitol Hill, there was a lawsuit brought against them in U.S. federal court to try to get them to take care of the families of some of the people that their information led to their arrest, and there was a lawsuit trying to get them to help the families of those people. The group that brought that lawsuit, I talked to them for the piece that I did, and at the time they told me, Yahoo has not been exactly forthcoming with what they've been doing to try to gain the release of those two dissidents that are in prison. They said that as far as the families are concerned, it looks like Yahoo is trying to help them as much as possible, but it's still unclear whether, you know, Yahoo feels enough pressure to really go ahead and talk with the Chinese government about getting those two dissidents released.
That's the world's technology correspondent and podcast mentor, Clark Boyd. His podcast, by the way, is more than 3 years old. That's really ancient in podcast years. Really impressive, too. Okay, now for a story that aired this past week on the occasion that a high school senior named Yasmin Hafiz got her picture taken with President Bush at the White House. She was one of 139 presidential scholars honored this week. Well, this story is also about speech, about being really, really careful with speech, lest people get the wrong idea. And you have to be careful if you're a Pakistani-American family living in Phoenix, Arizona, and you've just written a book called The American Muslim Teenager's Handbook. Here it is. Yasmin Hafiz remembers exactly when she got the idea to write a book. It was a couple of years after 9/11, and she was in a bookstore.
And I was just looking in the teen nonfiction section, and there are so many resources for other religions, like Christians and Jews, and there was nothing for Muslims.
For Yasmin's brother, Imran, the motivation wasn't just to write a book for Muslims, it was to write one for non-Muslims, like kids at his school who were ignorant about his religion.
People would say, oh, you can't play soccer with us. And when I would ask why, they would say, well, you're part of the Taliban.
Imran and Yasmin decided to write the book with their mother, Pakistani-born Dilara Hafiz. They wanted to get a sense of the Muslim teenage experience in the U.S., so they sent questionnaires to Muslim schools around the country.
It was all anonymous, just asked for their first name and their age.
Based on what they got back, they began outlining their book, chapter by chapter. One big issue was a universal teenage concern, the generation gap. But it was more pronounced for the many Muslim teens with immigrant parents. Some of those parents didn't approve of music, for example. Some even forbade it outright, says Dilara.
And therefore, to a teenager, they would not allow them to maybe go to a school dance or have an iPod or sing in the choir. And these edicts were causing a lot of stress in the life of your average teenager.
Dilara's kids are not your average teenagers, nor is she your average mother. They live in an upscale suburb of Phoenix, and the kids go to private school. They practice a moderate, some might say American, brand of Islam. The women in the family don't cover their hair, and in the book, they write about their admiration for other faiths. And then there's the chapter that deals with the four Ds.
Dating, dancing, drinking, drugs. And just having those mentioned, you know, upsets some people. But that's the reality that any teenager, regardless of their faith, is going to face.
Muslim publishers did not want to touch our book.
This is Yasmin again.
They felt we were saying things that were very provocative. But really, the reason it seems out there is because it's a new voice. We're not going along with the rest of the published material on Islam, necessarily.
And the critics aren't all Muslims. The family invites me to a talk they give at a local retirement community. After their presentation, the first question from the floor is, why does the Islamic world oppose the State of Israel? Yasmin and Imran tell the retirees that's not true. They don't oppose Israel's right to exist. Not exactly your run-of-the-mill issue for teenage authors. When he started on the book, Imran didn't realize he'd be ruffling so many feathers. But now he knows that ideas, even in a self-help book, can be threatening.
Maybe ideas are a little bit dangerous. Maybe ideas can challenge the status quo. And maybe our book could be one of those books that people remembered and said, all right, let's reevaluate the way that we do things.
Imran Hafiz is full of stories that speak to his situation as a Muslim, as a teenager, as an American. Sometimes there are contradictions, but sometimes all three identities fit together. Here's one instance when they did. One day, Imran brought his dumbek into school. That's a Turkish hand drum.
As I was walking to one of my classes, one of the big older kids, one of the seniors, he stopped me and said, what is that? I turned to him and I said, it's a drum. And he looked at it, he picked it up in his hands and turned it over. And he said, meet us in the plaza at lunch today. And then I met them. There were about five guys sitting in a circle with drums like these. And they told me to sit down. They told me to play for a little bit. They kind of looked at each other, nodded, and they said, all right, you can play with us. We were playing on that, and then a couple guys said, hey, let's name this group Weapons of Mass Percussion.
As Imran tells me the story, his mother flinches. She says she's relieved he's pronounced the word percussion clearly. Even after they've written a book expressing their moderate views, the Hafiz family knows that, as Muslims in America, they must choose their words carefully so they're not misunderstood. For The World, I'm Patrick Cox, Phoenix. One last note this week, a little tribute to the recently deceased George Carlin. George Carlin did not like euphemism. His theory was that Americans can't face the truth, so they invent what he called a soft language to protect themselves from it. I'm not sure if I agree that it's particular to American English, but it certainly led in his case to a scary rant he used to perform on stage about a condition in combat when a person's nervous system reaches breaking point. In the First World War, that was called shell shock, language that is about as clear and direct as you can get. Then in the Second World War, the same condition was renamed battle fatigue.
Doesn't seem to hurt as much. Fatigue is a nicer word than shock. Shell shock. Battle fatigue.
A few years later, in the Korean War, the way the condition was described took a further step away from reality. Operational exhaustion.
And the humanity has been squeezed completely out of the phrase. It's totally sterile now. Operational exhaustion. Sounds like something that might happen to your car.
And then came the war in Vietnam. And a new phrase, a phrase we still use.
Post-traumatic stress disorder. I'll bet you if we'd have still been calling it shell shock, some of those Vietnam veterans might have gotten the attention they needed at the time. I'll bet you that. I'll bet you that.
The late George Carlin. And that's it for this edition of The World in Words. I'm Patrick Cox. Go to theworld.org for more about our show. Also, join our Facebook group, which is also called The World in Words. And if you feel like sending me any comments, the address is language@pri.org. Thanks for listening.